Are you feeling resentful, burned out, and underpaid at work? We have created a masterclass for you. It's called Beat Burnout and Build Wealth. 3 simple steps to scale your income without changing jobs or specialties. If you want to join us, here's how it works. Tap the link in the show notes or go to tracybingaman.com/masterclass. Choose a time that works for you. And then bring your A game to the masterclass and be ready to take notes and then take action. Doing nothing and not attending this masterclass results in nothing. And unless you take action, you'll keep earning that same below market value income, feeling resentful and burned out. Change requires action, and signing up for the Beat Burnout and Build Wealth masterclass is the first best step to take. Head to the show notes or tracybingaman.com/masterclass to be the first to have access to your preferred dates and times and to find one that works for you. We'll see you there. Welcome to The PA Is In, the show created by PAs for PAs, where codependency with your supervising physician is a thing of the past, optimal team practice is the future, and physician associate has taken the place of physician assistant as the professional title of choice. I'm Tracy Bingaman, and I'm obsessed with redefining what success as a PA looks like and what it feels like. Here you'll find the mindset shifts, systems, and processes I use to escape healthcare burnout and integrate my work into my life. Work-life balance is a myth, and an integrated life where you thrive professionally, not a balancing act, is the goal here. My mission is to help you to grow into a unicorn PA who loves their job, has abundant energy, time to spare, and work optional financial freedom. The PA is in. From that friend from high school selling protein powder and wanting you to join her weight loss challenge, to influencers on the internet sharing their nutrition advice, we are constantly bombarded with so much information, sometimes, I would even say often, misinformation about what to eat and how to be healthy. It can feel incredibly overwhelming. As providers, our formal nutrition training is profoundly lacking, something that Colleen Sloan, registered dietitian and certified PA, host of Exam Room Nutrition Podcast and nutrition educator at heart, is on a mission to change. From changing our mindset about the importance of weight and BMI to asking our patients permission before we discuss hot button topics like weight and nutrition, Colleen shares a wealth of knowledge that can help us and our patients to lead healthier lives with better, more healthful nutrition. Without further ado, here she is, Colleen Sloan. Colleen, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Tracy, I'm so excited to chat with you today. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome. So could you tell us a little bit about you and your background as both a PA and as a dietitian?
Absolutely. So I went to college in South Florida. I went to Florida International University and I studied nutrition and dietetics. So I have my bachelor's degree in nutrition. And then I went on to get registered as a registered dietitian, which we'll get into in a little bit. And then I worked as a dietitian for about 5 years. And then I decided I really wanted to give more and do more for my patients. I felt like I had more to give to the community beyond just giving nutrition advice. So I applied to PA school. I stayed local in South Florida. So I went to Nova Southeastern University, which is in Davie, Florida, in 2015. I graduated in 2017 and have been working as a pediatric PA since then.
Awesome. So we're going to talk a little bit more about kids and nutrition later. But before we dive into all of the meat that we're going to talk about today, I have so many food puns that I'm going to be using. So just get ready. Can you clear up for us, what is the difference between a nutritionist or just some person on the internet giving advice on what we should or shouldn't be eating, calling themselves a fitness expert or a nutrition influencer versus a true registered dietitian?
This is such an important question. And if you speak to any registered dietitian, this actually makes them crazy because unfortunately, there are so many influencers out there who call themselves nutritionists and are giving really bad medical or nutrition advice, and it's inappropriate. So I'm really glad and super happy to define what the difference is because there is a difference. So I'm going to start out by saying all dietitians are nutritionists, but not all nutritionists are dietitians. Okay, so that's an important differentiation. So registered dietitian, sometimes they'll say registered dietitian nutritionist. The acronym is RD or RDN behind their name. We are nutrition professionals with extensive training in medical nutrition therapy. So RDs have earned at least a four-year degree, but now as of January of 2024, they are requiring a master's degree before you're even able to sit for the state board exam. And after obtaining your degree, you have to complete at least 1,200 hours of supervised practice. So that's like rotations, like something like in PA school. And then you have to sit for a board exam. It's additionally, a lot of states, well, most states actually require state licensure. So this is very much like PAs. You go to PA, you go to college, you go to PA school, you do rotations, you sit for a state board, you apply for state licensure. It's pretty much the same exact process, but at the end, dietitians get the credential RD. RD is a legally protected title. So each and every year, every 5 years, we have to credential. So meaning we have to submit a requirement of CEUs to maintain our continuing education and to stay up to date on the current guidelines. Some RDs actually can hold additional certifications in specialized areas. So there's things like a pediatric specialist or renal nutrition, nutrition support. Some can be diabetes educators, and that's just additional education that they received. Now, after all that, that's a lot of training. What are nutritionists? They have none of that. So nutritionist, there's actually no formal definition for what that means. Technically, anyone who gives out nutrition advice can call themselves a nutritionist. So you could promote special diets or lifestyles, powders or supplements, all of that. They can call themselves a nutritionist, but they don't have any rigorous nutrition training or background at all. In most states, graduates, quote unquote, of like these nutrition certification programs and things like that, can't legally take money from individuals for providing their nutrition services. So they truly legally are not allowed to bill for their services, although they are doing this. It is actually illegal. And some nutritionists have been publicly sued for providing illegal nutrition services. So for patients out there, if they say they found a nutritionist or they're working with a nutritionist, do your research and find out if they are a registered dietitian. Because sometimes we'll call ourselves nutritionists, and it's perfectly appropriate for me and other dietitians to call ourselves that. But for those who did not go to college, sit for the state board, and maintain their continuing education credits, they cannot call themselves a nutritionist.
And is that something you can look up? Like, I could look myself up on the state website to make sure that I'm licensed as a PA in the state of Pennsylvania. Could I look up registered dietitians by name on the state board of, I don't know, nutrition or what? Okay.
Yes, you absolutely can look them up because there is a certifying credentialing agency, and you can look them up in the state licensure as well too.
Okay. I think that's really important. If a patient comes to you and says, hey, I'm losing weight, or I want to lose weight, or I, you know, I'm working on my nutrition and I found this person who's going to help me. I think as providers who really want what's best for our patients, we can say, that's great. What's their name? I want to look them up. I want to make sure that they're going to take good care of you. Maybe even want to call them and say, hey, these are my concerns, or this is, you know, so that we can have this multidisciplinary approach to this patient's care. But I also think making sure patients know the difference, because every day, there are people cropping up saying they have the solution to and the thing that is going to help us to really get our nutrition in check. So let's talk about, oh, go ahead.
I want to linger here because what you just said is really important, because not only dietitians are trained about nutrition, but they are also trained in medical nutrition therapy. So they understand chronic diseases. They understand renal disease and diabetes and the mechanics behind it and what's happening biologically in order to provide appropriate nutrition therapy for that specific patient. Whereas a nutritionist who might be in the gym, let's say your personal trainer, he doesn't know anything about diabetes, or if you're a chronic kidney disease patient and you're coming to them to help you lose weight. There are very specific nutrients and very important, you know, guidelines that need to be followed for each specific medical condition that dietitians are trained in and nutritionists aren't.
Yeah. And I think that as a practice, we as providers are missing this. So we are, instead of referring someone to a registered dietitian, we are probably at best giving them a handout and saying, hey, you should eat less carbs, you're now diabetic. And that's the whole thing. That's the whole discussion. Patients don't know what a carb is, what a complex carb is, what a simple carb is. Like, I didn't even know that from my own education. Like, those are things that as a person, I decided I think I want to know as I'm feeding myself and my family. But it just seems like this big gap in care where in PA school, they said lifestyle modifications, quote unquote, next slide, right? Like, we didn't learn what the lifestyle modifications were. And so we're telling patients, hey, now you have hypertension, now you have, you know, heart failure, now you have diabetes, go forth and live better. But we're not really telling them exactly what to do.
No, you hit the nail on the head exactly, because we think we're doing them, you know, benefit by saying, okay, don't eat carbs. And it's not the fault of the patient. They just go home and they then Google, don't eat, you know, what is a carbohydrate, carb-free diet, and they're getting all kinds of misinformation. Whereas I would rather, as the provider, either educate yourself or get a handful of registered dietitians that you know, you trust, you respect, and just provide referrals for those if you don't have the time in clinic, because that's reality. We really don't have an hour and a half to sit and do a counseling session. But I would rather you provide helpful, accurate information than misinformation, or guide your patients down the wrong, you know, rabbit hole that they're going to go in through Google.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much information on the internet. And even as providers, you could Google it and you would be shocked at some of the stuff that's coming up. So don't send your patients home to find information on their own. Give them your trusted websites, give them your, you know, provider resources so that they can, you know, they're going to do what they're going to do, but at least then you can sleep well at night knowing I gave them the appropriate tools. I put in the referral to the dietitian. Are dietitian visits covered by insurance? Is this something that patients have to pay for, or are they covered?
Yeah. So interestingly, more and more they are being covered as medical nutrition therapy. More and more insurance companies are covering this service. And on my podcast, I actually just did a talk about what services are covered and how this can happen. A lot of dietitians accept insurance. They also accept HSA, so health savings account, or FSA funds as a way to provide for services as well too. So that's an option that a lot of patients didn't know. Specifically, of course, diabetes is a covered service, so you can always just write that as a diagnosis. And chronic kidney disease is as well too. There is a bill currently out there that is hopefully being passed for more medical nutrition therapy covered services. There's a lot of ways around it too. A lot of dietitians can submit a super bill for their patient to submit to the insurance, and then the patient can get reimbursed that way as well too.
Yeah. Yeah. Which makes sense to me when I think about the business of an insurance company. A healthier person who has better nutrition, who loses weight and controls their diabetes, costs that insurance company less, but their premiums are the same. So to me, that would make good business sense to pay for nutrition counseling at a registered dietitian for your patients, because they're not going to get hospitalized. You're not going to have DKA. They're not going to have some of these complications of this disease process. So that makes sense to me. Let's talk about, so people are listening and they're like, that sounds great. However, right? However, I don't have, as you said, an hour and a half to sit with these patients and ask them what they're eating and how they're feeling and how their bowels are moving, unless maybe that's part of our normal clinical practice. What should we be asking everyone about nutrition? Is this something we should be covering in physical, you know, when people come in for their annual exam? Should it be a part of every visit? What's the gold standard that we should be aiming for here?
I'm so passionate about this, and I actually polled a group of PAs asking what their greatest barrier is to discussing nutrition, and time constraints was the biggest one. And I feel that I'm in pediatric primary care, so I'm in a very high volume, high paced clinic. And so I feel those time constraints, but it's doable. And I've dedicated a lot of my podcast to teaching clinicians how to do this, but I always stress the importance of, first and foremost, you need to address the patient's primary concern first, before you even talk about their weight or diet. So doing so is going to show the patient that you're listening to them, you're responding to their concerns and needs before even touching on their weight, because this is a very sensitive subject. And I've had a lot of feedback from patients who say, hey, I came in for, you know, sore throat, or I twisted my ankle, and the clinician was like, oh, hey, you know, you should probably lose some weight, or your BMI is in the obese range. But they're not coming in to discuss that. That's not their concern at all. They're worried about their sore throat or their hurt ankle. So keep that in mind. Make sure you're addressing the patient's primary concern first, because that's why they're there. They're coming to you for solutions for that one specific issue. Now, if this is an annual physical, I would absolutely hope that you're bringing this up. This is the time to do so, because often patients either haven't seen you in a year or more. I mean, in the, you know, even in the pediatric world, I'll go 3 or 4 years without seeing a teenage patient, and so much has happened. So please be asking about nutrition, but do it tactfully and respectfully. The most important and best piece of advice that I can give is to ask the patient permission before you even talk about their diet or their weight. And I really don't care how old the patient is. I do this in pediatrics for kiddos who are like 10 years old, 8 even, because studies are showing that even 8, 9, and 10-year-olds are developing eating disorders because of an inappropriate comment about weight. So there's a couple ways that I encourage clinicians to ask permission. And it starts really with your MA when they're weighing the patient. So first and foremost, I like to give them the option to have a blind weight. So the MA could say, hey, we're going to weigh you today. Would you like to know what that weight is, or would you prefer to do a blind weight? And a blind weight is simply the patient turns around and steps backwards on the scale, and you don't tell them what the weight is. So that's the first way that permission can be asked. The other ways is with the clinician. So before you even go into the nutrition portion of your visit, I want you to start to ask, hey, is it okay if I ask you some questions about the foods that you eat in a day? Most often they're going to say yes, that's fine. If they say no, then you need to respect their choices. It's their body, it's their visit, that's okay. And then next, once you review their weight, or if it's, you know, pediatric world and you're looking at a growth chart, or the adult world and you're kind of looking over the last couple of years, then I need you to ask, are you comfortable talking about your weight today? Or is it okay if we talk about your weight? Because this gives the patient autonomy and kind of like a heads up, like, hey, we're moving into something that might be a little bit sensitive today. And are you comfortable with it? Especially for the pediatric world, teenager kids, you know, we'll get into more specifics on how to do this with kids. But this is so, so important, because sometimes they're not comfortable with it. Or they don't want to talk about it with their siblings in the room or family members that are in the room. So that's a really important area that you need to be sensitive about. Now, how do we ask about the foods that they eat? This can sometimes be difficult, because the quickest question that you can do is, are you eating okay? And it's like, well, that's not a very open-ended question. You don't get much detail, because the patient's probably saying, yep, I eat fine.
Yeah. Like, I'm not vomiting, right? Like, that's like, yeah. Or are you getting enough fruits and vegetables? Like, what's enough? Like, sure. Feels like it. Yeah.
Exactly. So start broad. So start with open-ended questions, and then you can zoom in. So I always love to start by asking, do you have any concerns about your weight today? Or how do you feel about your weight today? So if they don't have any concerns, okay, that's okay. But we still should probably get some more information. And then typically we need to move into their typical eating pattern. So I would like to learn more about the typical foods you eat in a day. Some patients can answer that question, no problem. Sometimes they need a little bit more prying, a little bit more guidance. So another question is like, what kinds of foods do you eat in a normal day? They need some more guiding, then you can walk them through each meal. Like, okay, do you eat breakfast? Or what time is the first time that you eat food? Because people think breakfast, and if they're, you know, sleeping in until 1 o'clock in the afternoon, well, no, I don't eat breakfast, but I'm up at one, you know, so I do eat right when I wake up. So that's a great way to ask about like the first time that they're eating. What do you eat for lunch? Do you pack a lunch? Are you eating out more often? And then same thing with dinner. Do you make dinner at home? Are you cooking? Are you eating out? Are you ordering takeout? And then I love to ask about snacks, because people way overestimate, you know, the amount of snacks that they're having. So most of us are consuming between 500 and 800 calories in snacks and beverages throughout the day. So that's like your coffee drink in the afternoon, or your sweet tea with lunch, and then that little few handfuls of cookies from the break room, or, you know, that chips bag on the run. So those add up really, really easily. So I always ask, do you eat in between meals, and what are you eating? Then it's really important to find out how often patients are eating as well too. So if you're kind of getting a picture of like, wow, you're eating at 6 a.m. when you leave for work, and you're not eating again until 7 p.m., you know, when you're home and you pick the kids up, that's a really long time to be skipping meals. And so no wonder they might be struggling with, you know, binge eating at night or really just excessively overeating late night because they've missed 6 to 7 hours of fueling throughout the day. The last and most important question to talk about when you're talking about diet and nutrition is asking about their emotions around the food and what their coping mechanisms are. So I like to ask something like this. Do you find that you eat more or differently when you're stressed or lonely or bored? Because emotional eating is a huge factor that comes into weight management. And sometimes it's not really what they're eating all day. Maybe they were great from 8 to 8. And then, you know, nighttime comes and they just went through a breakup or they just got laid off from their job. And they're really, really stressed and worried about that. And they cope with food. So you need to figure out what are those coping mechanisms and if there are areas that need to be improved.
Thinking of a career shift in 2024? Advanced Scope is one of the only PA consulting firms optimizing your job hunt without taking away from your earning potential. They don't dip into your paycheck and your job search remains 100% confidential at no cost to you. Through partnering with practices nationwide, they know about opportunities before LinkedIn or Indeed even posts them. Connect with their CEO, Madison, today by going to advancedscopetalent.com and booking an exploratory call. Your future career and paycheck will thank you. Yeah, I think that, first of all, asking them permission as a general thing for providers, I think that permission is assumed. Like, I think as providers, we say, well, they're here. Don't they want my advice? And they are there. But unless they're there for a weight-related complaint, and honestly, even if they are there for a weight-related complaint, they may not feel like they're in a good headspace to talk about it at that time. So I think that's just such a gift to your patients to say, hey, you know, are you up for this? Like, we're going to go there. Here's your warning flag that we're going to talk about this. Stop me now. You know, we should be doing that as part of physical exams. Is this okay that I'm doing, you know, can I look at your stomach? Can I look at your, you know, I think students are very careful about that. So this is something I've observed as a preceptor. When I take my kids to the pediatrician, they have PA students and the PA students are like, okay, I'm going to examine them now. I'm like, okay. And then they're like, is it okay if I listen to his heart? I'm like, yeah, it's fine. You know, but they are very, they aren't sure what they're allowed to do. So they ask permission every step. I'm like, I haven't asked permission in a decade, right? I have just gone in and taken a look like I, you know, because that's my job. So I think, you know, pausing, slowing that interaction down, letting the patient lead and asking them, you know, are you okay with this? Are you okay to talk about this? Because it is something that is so, so triggering. It has been, you know, as a society, we have made weight really the thing that we think is the measure of health. You know, we think that the way that someone looks is the way that they're functioning, is the way metabolically they're working. And that's not quite true. So let's talk a little bit about pediatric patients. So how to sort of navigate this with kids, or we can talk about adults first, or, you know, whichever you want. So how do we, with different populations, you know, how do we tread lightly with this in different age groups?
Yeah. So I think it's a mindset shift, first of all. So we'll kind of, you know, let's talk about our older adult or our adult patients first, and maybe even the teenage patients. I need clinicians to remember it's a mindset shift, especially when you're counseling patients about weight and diet. It's not our job as clinicians to change our patients. It's just not. You can't change your patients. You can't change their mind. But what you can do is support and guide them on their journey. So this is where asking questions to unpack the patient's motivation for wanting to change is really, really important, because you need to bring that up front. The patients need to see and understand why they want to change. And you can help them with that, because it's not our job to change them or to force them to change or to force something on them that they don't want. So after you've asked permission, we've already established that it's okay to discuss this and they're comfortable with it. The next way is to just state the facts about their weight. Last year you weighed X and this year you weigh Y. If they've increased weight and they're in an unhealthy range, you can say this puts you at an unhealthy weight and at risk for some long-term medical challenges. I want you to just completely avoid using anything demeaning. This makes you fat. This means that you're obese. For kids, sometimes clinicians will call them chubby. Those are really offensive and nobody needs to hear that. And honestly, those are probably voices that the patients are already telling themselves in their heads that are negative in the first place. They don't need the clinician who they're supposed to trust and respect and love. They don't need them telling them that. So they already know this. So once you've just kind of stated the facts and said, hey, your weight is this, and it might be putting you at risk for some long-term medical challenges, now you need to ask some change-provoking questions. So I like to ask them, what do you think would be different in your life if you lost weight? Because this now makes them look at their life, right? I mean, it's totally different if you're talking to a 20-something young adult versus a 60-year-old adult. What would be different in their life would be drastically different in those two cases. So the next thing that I like to ask them would be, in what ways do you want your health to be different? So this takes the pressure now off the weight too. And we're looking at like, no, I'm talking about, do you want to get off these medications? Would you like to feel more comfortable sitting in an airplane seat? Would you like to be proud of yourself, you know, that you were able to walk around the block without getting exhausted or go to the playground with your kids without needing to take breaks? So really helping them see how improving their health would impact their overall wellness and satisfaction and enjoyment with life is so important. I also like to ask, in what ways would your family benefit from you losing weight? I think this is a good one to ask moms and dads, especially who have kids and even grandparents. I mean, we all want to be around for our family. We all want to live the most vibrant, healthful life possible. And just bringing that to mind is a really important and helpful mindset shift to guiding our patients to like, okay, you said you wanted to be able to play with your kids on the floor and, you know, not get too tired. How are we going to get there? What steps can we do? What behavior changes can we make in order to help you achieve that goal? Now, the next thing is patients will come in and say, well, I need a diet because I want to lose weight, right? They love the word diet. There's some sexiness to being put on a diet. But honestly, diets, you can't last on a diet long term. They're not sustainable. They're initially sexy, but once you're having to restrict and refrain from your favorite foods for a few weeks, honestly, it gets old and it gets boring and you are really, really craving those foods. And then people fall off the wagon and then we're on this yo-yo dieting train. But when someone says that they are looking for a diet or they want a diet, it tells me three things. It tells me that they're ready to improve their eating habits, that they're motivated, and that they're looking for information. So I love to respond when people say, hey, I need a diet. I love to say, hey, I'm so happy that you've chosen to make your health a priority. It sounds like you're really motivated, because this kind of, again, shifts them into that, yeah, I am ready. I need to do this. And diets are so appealing because it offers the patient structure and like a clear plan. But they don't work. They're restrictive. They're impossible to stick to long term. And then we're on this merry-go-round. And not every diet works for every patient. I think this is such an important thing to remember because, you know, what keto diet or intermittent fasting, which are kind of like the two big ones right now, might work for some people because their schedule works like that. For me, for example, I would starve to death and be a hangry monster if you made me eat in eating windows like intermittent fasting is, because I'm up really, really early and I actually work really, really late. So I can't have eating windows because I need to be able to eat when I'm hungry and as I'm working. So getting to know your patient, their lifestyle and schedule is really, really key to finding the best approach for them. Because, hey, keto might work for some people. Intermittent fasting might actually work for some people, but it doesn't work for everybody. So just giving like blanket diets is not helpful. But I want to give your listeners a few surefire things, you know, because we're in the clinic, we've asked all these questions, the patient is ready, they're like eager for something. And I agree with you, I hate handouts. I think they're so useless and people just throw them out and they don't give enough information. And I know we feel like we're giving them something, so it's better than nothing, but I would rather you give your patients this advice. So I want you to suggest that they follow an add-in approach to start. So what are we adding in? I don't want you to remove anything from their diet. So if they tell you that, hey, I'm eating fried chicken and I really like chicken tenders and I eat pancakes for breakfast, for now, as we're just getting started, don't remove those things. Add things in. And those things should be colorful things. So I tell all my patients, hey, you know what? We're not going to remove any of your favorite foods because I'm not going to ruin that for you right now. But I want you to look at every meal and every snack and look at the plate and say, what can I add in to make this more healthful? And I want you to have at least two colors on every plate. So think red, green, yellow, orange. And what are those? Fruits and vegetables. Because study after study after study has shown that increase in fruits and vegetables increases longevity, decreases chronic medical conditions, improves cholesterol, improves diabetes, improves hypertension. So many benefits from fruits and vegetables. Not only do they have antioxidants, so they improve cancer fighting properties, but they also have fiber. And fiber is going to be like the king of 2024. So if your patients can increase their fiber, they're going to be increasing their feeling of fullness or satiety. So including more fruits and vegetables, have them do that for 2 weeks and say, hey, come back to me in 2 weeks. Once we're there, once you're consistently having two colorful fruits or vegetables at each meal, then let's add in another new healthy change. And that will be different for every patient. That might be, hey, can we do something other than pancakes for breakfast? And let's do that for 2 weeks. Or, hey, let's try to have some more protein at each meal and snack because it looks like you're getting kind of full or your blood pressure or your blood sugar is kind of spiking a little bit too quickly. So let's add some protein type foods in. See me back in 2 weeks or a month or something like that. Those few changes are much more helpful and sustainable than complete just diet plan completely different from anything that they've ever eaten.
Most PAs bring home a decent paycheck, but aren't sure that they're investing enough or what approach to take for student loans. Kayla Pepperday is a certified financial planner who works specifically with APPs. Seeing that PAs, including his wife, were overlooked and physicians were treated with respect in the financial planning industry, he sought to rectify this mismatch by serving PAs with the excellence we deserve. Caleb's mission is to help make financial planning affordable for APPs regardless of their asset level. Head to advancedpracticeplanning.com and hit the schedule a conversation button to book your free consult. Your money is your largest wealth building tool, and failing to utilize it well could leave you wanting to retire without enough in your accounts or still having student loan payments when your kids are ready to attend college themselves. Caleb's clients can enjoy their money guilt-free while feeling confident in their savings and investments. Head to the show notes, tap the link, and call Caleb for your free consultation. On the call, Caleb will help you to determine whether his one-time or ongoing financial planning services are right for you. Yeah, I think that already sounds better than here's a list of the things that you can't eat, or here's a list of the things that you can eat, or follow this exact meal plan where breakfast is this and lunch is this, because that feels good. And I do think that structure, especially as someone who identifies as like type A, I'm like, yes, like tell me exactly what to do, like give me the plan. However, today has already not gone according to plan and it's 11 a.m. Right? It just didn't, right? One kid had a thing and this the thing. And so you're like, I've already failed, right? I've already fallen off the wagon and it's not even lunchtime yet. So giving them, hey, more of this, not less of, I think that's a really great approach to get them on board. And I love the short-term follow-up, right? So don't send them and say, see you in a year, hope it goes well, you know, short-term follow-up so we can continue to work on this so I can partner with you on this journey. How do we talk to kids about this? I feel like there's probably a lot of providers who aren't talking about it with kids because they're fearful that they're going to say or do something that's going to make weight a problem for a kid, that it's maybe not a problem or add some stigma around that. So how can we, you know, thoughtfully, compassionately talk to kids about weight and nutrition?
So I'm going to get some big eyes and confusing looks, but the newer guidelines are recommending that weight should never be discussed in front of the child. The child needs to be put out of the room. And I know that's really hard, but coming from me, I have a very, very high volume of patients. And I know you're like, oh my gosh, I don't have time to put the child out and where they're going to go. Make it happen, because there are so many detrimental things that happen to kids when you talk about their weight in front of them, especially if they are on the overweight side. So parents are notorious for doing this, and they'll say, he's too fat. Like, how do I get him to lose weight? Right in front of the kid, and the kid's, you know, 8 or 9 years old. I have a story about a young boy who was 9, and he saw me as a sick visit. So this was not a well check at all. He was there for like a rash or something like that. But when I walked in the room, he was crying, and I wasn't expecting him to be crying because there weren't shots, right? And I asked him, like, what's wrong, sweetheart? Why are you crying? And the mom had said, well, he's just really upset because he didn't lose weight and he actually gained 2 pounds. And I had a very confused look, and I'm like, why do you think that you need to lose weight? And he said, well, the other doctor before you at my last checkup said that I'm too heavy and that I need to lose weight. And the next time I'm here, that I better have lost weight. And my heart sank for him because he's 9. And he was not considered morbidly obese at all. His percentile was actually like 90th, 95th percentile. He's also prepubescent. So if we remember back from school, prepuberty is a time for weight gain. We're preparing for these growth hormones and for hormonal changes for puberty and for into adulthood. And it's very common for children to grow out, and then they grow up. And then they grow out, and then they grow up throughout puberty, and especially boys. This young man could have grown well into his 20s. You know, I mean, boys keep growing and growing thanks to testosterone. So I just took a deep breath, and I had to kind of tell this young man, your body is healthy, and these changes are actually appropriate, and I don't want you to be focusing on your weight at all. Mom had said that he had been weighing himself every single day since the last visit, which was 7 months prior to that visit. 7 months he'd been weighing himself every day, and he's 9. And so I'm so passionate about this because this impacted the child's life so significantly to the point where he cried when he came into the office because he didn't lose weight. And he didn't even need to lose weight. So to protect the mental health of the future of our society, I cannot stress how important it is to not talk about the child's weight in front of them. Now, if they're older, you know, 13, 15, 16, some clinicians, some dietitians actually recommend if they're 18 and younger to not even bring it up to them at all. I will sometimes bring it up because sometimes they're feeding themselves, you know, especially in the summer, if they're home all alone, they do need to be educated healthfully. But weight is not the primary indicator of health. You can have a kiddo who's at the 75th percentile and appears to be a quote unquote healthy weight who just grows on cereal and mac and cheese all day. That is not considered a healthful diet, right? He's missing so many macronutrients, including protein and different fiber sources. But just because his weight is healthy, the clinician could say, your weight's fine, no worries, we're going to move right on. But that's actually inappropriate. So I don't like focusing on weight in pediatrics at all, because again, we're expecting them to grow. They're kids. They need to be growing. They need to be changing. Now, of course, we have some drastic, you know, morbidly obese kiddos who are well off the curve, well into the 150th percentile for their weight. And yes, this should be addressed, but with mom and dad. It doesn't need to be addressed with the kid. What you can address with the kid is the types of foods that they're eating. Because if we can change behaviors, and that's where clinicians need to focus their outcomes on, is behaviors. They should not be focusing their outcomes on weight loss, BMI changes. We need to focus on outcomes. We need to focus on behavior outcomes. So things like, hey, you didn't skip breakfast this week. I'm so proud of you. That's awesome because you're fueling your brain so you can sit through school really well. Or you packed your lunch this whole week. Good job. I bet you that, you know, ham and cheese sandwich was pretty good and you were able to run really fast in PE. So those things are what kids understand. They don't really understand the need to lose weight. They don't really want to lose weight. They want to run fast and be smart and keep up with their friends and just feel good naturally. So focusing on weight primarily is very detrimental. Honestly, even for adults, we have way better metrics than weight and BMI that we need to be focusing on. Because if we can change behaviors, the weight is just a natural byproduct of being healthier and choosing healthier foods. So really just taking that verbiage out that I'm gonna see where your weight is in 3 months. No, why don't we just see, you know, how many fruits and vegetables you can eat every day and talk to me in 3 months? Because I promise you their weight will come down, especially after not stressing them out so much about it.
Yeah. So this has been something that, as someone who is raised in this culture of like Weight Watchers and parents saying we're being good, we're not being bad, we're not cheating, you know, all of this has an impact on how we see ourselves, on how we see food. I try to be very diligent about this with the kids. I'm sure I'm not doing it perfectly, but one of our kids one morning we had eggs for breakfast. My husband on the weekends will cook like sometimes pancakes, sometimes French toast, but oftentimes eggs, and you get to pick how your eggs are prepared. So the kids like it because they get to choose their, you know, omelet versus scrambled. And one of our kids had 3 eggs one morning, and he was young, like maybe 4 or 5. And I said, wow, like you're going to be so strong from all of that protein. And he was just like, he interpreted that to mean strong and helpful. So he thought that eggs made you strong and like helpful and well-behaved. So that whole day he was like, I'm helping dad with this. You should see how strong I am. I'm lifting. And I was like, wow, you're also like being great. He was like, that's the eggs. Like he thought like eggs made his behavior better. And I was like, I will feed this kid eggs every meal if I think that it's going to make him behave better and listen better. But, and he has not forgotten that. So that was years and years ago. He's now almost 9. And still when we have eggs, he's like, oh yeah, I can feel it. Like he thinks it's like immediate strength, immediately well-behaved. And I'm like, I don't hate this. I want him to think that like these eggs are super powerful, but they are definitely, definitely listening to what we're saying, to the properties that we're attributing to certain foods. Like our kids think that carrots make them see in the dark. So they'll like turn the lights off and they're like, look, I can see everything in here because I've been eating my carrots. I'm like, great. You know, great. If you think that, that's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, our words matter. And I say this probably on every lecture that I do, your words truly matter for the better or worse. And so even just this young child, he was 9. I mean, that clinician said that 7 months prior and he held on to that. And so the opposite is true too. So I love that about the eggs and superpowers and you're like super good. Because kids really do kind of believe these things about food and about their bodies. And so when you're educating kids, especially in the pediatric world, you're also re-educating parents. You know, even think back to yourself and your own biases and your own maybe struggle or journey with weight or dieting or nutrition. It's very easy to push that onto your own child, especially as moms, if we have body image complex and we look in the mirror and we say, oh, I'm too fat. I need to lose weight. Or I need to be good today. Your young daughter who's watching you do that is also going to look in the mirror and find something about her that isn't right. And so if we can just completely change the narrative about being positive about, number one, our bodies, but about also the foods that we eat, and it's okay to learn to enjoy a sweet because it's somebody's birthday and actually that food is fine, and we don't need to kind of delineate between healthy and good foods and unhealthy and bad foods. All foods have a purpose and all foods can fit and all foods have value and can be enjoyed together. I think teaching that is the most important thing for kids to do of like, hey, this food might, you know, help me run faster or give me, you know, superpowers like the eggs did. And I think that's kind of the route that we need to go when we educate our kids.
Yeah. And our kids have started asking, they're like, what does this food give me? And so we are often like, and I don't always know, right? I feel like carrots are just one, like my parents told me carrots were good for your vision. So I am propagating that potential myth, but maybe truth to my own kids. But sometimes they're like, why does broccoli matter? Right. So like last night we're having like a meal and broccoli's included, which sometimes goes well and sometimes doesn't go well. You know, at our house, it's probably we're 60% success rate on that being consumed. But my 6-year-old said, why do I need to eat this broccoli? And I said, first of all, you don't need to eat it. But second of all, it's good for you because, right? So like I looked it up, I'm Googling properties of broccoli, you know, like I'm like lots of calcium, right? I'm like telling him, you know, because I don't know all the properties of all of the foods. And I'm like, calcium makes your bone strong. Like, this is a six-year-old's level of understanding, and it's, you know, potentially higher than mine. But just like being open to changing the way that you have thought about that. I think even I was in school, you know, 12 to 15 years ago, and we were sort of making it seem like weight was the primary indicator of health. Like BMI was the thing that mattered. And simply by being in a higher BMI, you're at risk for all these things, which may be true for some people, but also there's more muscle, right? So BMI and weight are not like the be all end all. Before we wrap up, I want to change gears a little bit and talk to the clinicians listening about their own nutrition. So I think this is something where like, hey, do as I say, not as I do, because I have, you know, 32 patients today and I'm running from here and there. So we're neglecting our own nutrition. What are some tips that you can give us as busy, you know, providers who have lots of demands inside and outside of work that we can sort of fine tune or make a little progress in what we're using to fuel our own bodies?
I think it's so important to fuel yourself for success, right? Because you can't give great recommendations and give good medical advice and just be a good clinician if you are hungry and your blood sugar has dropped and you've got a headache, right? Like, you have got to take care of yourself first and foremost. Of course, sleep is a big one. I know you talk about this a lot, but specifically with nutrition, I have a couple tips for you. The first one is you have to eat breakfast. You have to eat breakfast. I don't care if you don't feel hungry in the morning. That's the number one, you know, that's the number one reason why people tell me they can't eat breakfast. Well, I don't feel hungry. Okay, but I promise your body still needs breakfast. Like, you've fasted all night long. You are hungry. You need to replenish your energy stores. So eat breakfast. And when I say breakfast, I don't mean an omelet and fruit and a bagel. Like, I don't mean it has to be this really big, extravagant meal. I eat breakfast in my car on my way to work. So, and when I mean breakfast, it doesn't have to be Western breakfast foods. You know, here in the US, we're so used to like eggs and toast for breakfast, but you have like a buffalo wrap leftover from the weekend, throw that in a bag, and that's your breakfast. I eat sandwiches probably 5 mornings out of 7 because they're just quick and easy and I have it left over from the morning. It doesn't have to make sense. Literally, I've had half a hamburger for breakfast before because that's all I had, but I knew I needed something. Smoothies are great if you have time to make a smoothie or if you enjoy smoothies, because you could throw in tons of fruits and vegetables. You can make it with milk or soy to get some protein, throw in flax seeds or chia seeds to add a little bit of fiber in there as well too. Again, if you have time, you can also make smoothies ahead of time and just keep them in the fridge or freezer for the week and just kind of replenish them and stir them up to make them taste a little bit better. You can also make overnight oats. Those are a really quick and easy thing to do on Sunday nights, and that you could just Google overnight oats. There are tons of people out there who have amazing recipes, from sweet things like throwing fruit in there to like more savory, like having a little bit of chocolate and almonds in there. But it's a really good way to get some fiber and protein in your system, because breakfast is so, so important. But keep it easy and do what works for you. The next thing is water. Nobody drinks enough water, and this is so, so important. The best strategy that I have for drinking enough water is first thing in the morning. So this could be when you're putting on your makeup or when you're packing up the kids' breakfast or getting them off to school. Grab a bottle of water, whether it's, you know, regular plastic water, bottle of water, or just fill a large glass of water, at least 16 ounces, and drink that while you're doing something over the first 20, 30 minutes of the day. Because that's a quick and easy way to get water in your system before the craziness of the day starts. Because once the day gets rolling, it is really easy to forget about water. Then throughout the day, I suggest you get a big water bottle so you can refill that throughout the day, or so you don't even have to keep refilling it. Because like, if you have, you know, these Zephyr Hills that are only 16 ounces of water, I can drink that over lunch and then I have nothing left for after lunch. So I like to have just a bigger water bottle that I can sip on throughout the day. I know you're going to tell me, well, drinking water makes me pee a lot and I'm so busy, I don't have time to pee. I get it. But your kidneys and the rest of your body will thank you. Just take the bathroom break and drink enough water, okay? Quick and easy way to know how much water you need is take your body weight and divide it in half, and that's how many ounces you should drink throughout the day. A very basic, quick and easy. Obviously, there are nuances if you are an athlete or anything like that, or sweat a lot, or a high, you know, high heat environment. might be a little bit different, but at least half of your body weight in ounces is a great place to start. But use your urine. I mean, we're clinicians, we know this. Use your urine color to determine if you've had enough water or not. But water is so, so important for our health. Okay, the next one is to keep nutritious snacks on hand for quick energy if you miss lunch or if you had to skip breakfast or something like that. So I like to keep some things in my office drawer. Things like dried chickpeas or edamame is a really good, quick and easy, crunchy, salty snack that's high in protein and high in fiber. A cheese stick, you can throw like a pack of them into the office fridge that you can munch on really quickly. Apples are another really good one that I like to pair either with the cheese or with peanut butter. And you can buy little small single servings of peanut butter and just keep those in the office as well too. But keeping something, or even in your bag, in your lab coat, keeping some snacks there, if you can prevent yourself from getting so, so hungry that then once you're in the cafeteria or in the doctor's office or the break room, and that's when there's the, you know, the cake because it's somebody's birthday, or that's when there's all those treats from the vendors. If you've snacked on something nutritious that fills you up, you are less likely to go and binge and crave on that item because you're not just completely starving. And then lastly, you need to prioritize protein throughout the day. This helps with satiety and blood sugar control. And really all of these things that I mentioned, breakfast, healthful snacks, and protein throughout the day will help with feeling of fullness and keeping your blood sugars from spiking and decreasing. So protein at breakfast can be challenging for some people because if you don't like eggs, it can again be tricky, but that's again where you consider you don't have to have breakfast foods for breakfast. So some source of meat or beans is a great source. Of course, milk and dairy and soy are other good sources of protein for breakfast. Lunch and dinner are a little bit easier because if you eat meat, you're getting plenty of protein. But if you are going at least 4 to 6 hours in between meals, you have to be having a snack that has that source of protein in addition, just to help keep your energy sources up and keep your blood sugar stabilized. So that's when pairing like a fruit and nuts or, you know, crackers and cheese is a really good combination because you are getting some carbohydrates and protein to help you last longer and throughout the day.
Awesome. Thank you so much. You guys can't see me because you won't be able to see my part of the video when Colleen's talking, but I'm like taking notes like, oh yes, chickpea. I'm like, like taking notes of stuff that I'm going to put in my office drawer. So before we sort of sign off and tell everyone where they can find you and your podcast, I would like you to, now I don't want to go on too much of a rant about this, but there are in my newsfeed right now, 47 people who I went to high school or PA school or this, that, or the other thing who are posting about this shake, this protein powder, this supplement, this magical thing that they have been doing that has helped them to have more energy, lose weight, live their best life, like better skin, more amazing hair, like a better marriage. I'm like, I don't know how all of these things are a result of this supplement, but like, what? What can you tell us about these things? How can we sort of stop letting those things affect us? Or what advice do you have about supplements and magic powders?
Oh, the vast array of things that solve all your problems out there. Honestly, if there was one, I would love to have it because I want that too, right? But there's something to be said about what our guidelines say, and the guidelines are standards for a reason. I've never seen any guideline or standard promise a quick fix. And it kind of goes back to the theory of like, yeah, you know, eating healthy is not that sexy, right? But if you can just maintain consistency in what you're doing, I promise you, you will get the results. It's where when people fall off the wagon, right? Quote unquote, oh, I fell off the wagon. I'm not doing my diet anymore. That's when we fall back to old habits. But the people who are just maintaining consistency in their exercise routine and they're getting up and they've committed to 3 days a week and they walk during lunch instead of sitting in their car, consistency is what gives you results. And this is true in everything in life, right? Like if you consistently love and serve your spouse, you'll probably have a good marriage. If you consistently save money slowly over time, you know, $20 every month, you're going to have a pretty decent amount of savings in your account. And that's the same with nutrition, but it's so easy to get caught up in the results that someone else is getting or a quick fix because we do all want that. You know, in the day and age of social media where it's instant gratification, we want the same in all facets of our life. And unfortunately, that's just not true. And so for you as a clinician, don't fall prey to any of these supplements or juices or powders, anything that you had said, because they definitely won't give you those results long term. Sure, I can guarantee if you try this juice instead of eating lunch, you're going to lose 20 pounds. Why? You are reducing your calorie intake. It's nothing special about that juice because, again, most of these products are not monitored by the FDA. So the claims that they're making are really unfounded. And we as clinicians should not support anything that has not been proven or approved by the FDA because we don't know what kind of side effects it might impact our patients. That's number one. And number two, really, if you just follow the general healthy guidelines for patients consistently, I promise you, you will get those results and it will last long term. The other thing with these supplements and magic things is there's a cost to them, right? So I always stay clear of any of those things because number one, it's a really big increase in cost and really we can't maintain that for long term. And we don't know the long term outcome effects. Like, okay, how long am I going to have to be on this? And is it going to prove that it has weight loss and all these other benefits? So really, if you just stick to principles and help your patients just stick to the principles, eat more colorful foods, try to minimize as much fried foods and sugary sweetened things as possible, and move your body. I promise you, those three things will give you the results that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah, I love that reminder that consistency is the secret sauce. It is not actually the magic powder that is giving you the results for sure. So I know that I love to tune into your show. So tell us where everyone can go to find more of you, to tune into your podcast, and to connect with you online.
So I am the host of the Exam Room Nutrition Podcast, which is a podcast dedicated to teaching you the nutrition education you never got in school, because we all know we weren't really taught anything in school, in PA school, medical school, NP school, about nutrition at all, but our patients are asking a lot of nutrition questions. So my podcast really is dedicated to just helping you answer those kind of common nutrition questions in clinic. And then of course, referring to dietitians. So I love supporting and promoting registered dietitians as the healthcare professionals, as the nutrition professionals. So you can find that podcast on anywhere that you listen to podcasts. So Apple and Spotify are the biggest ones. You can find me online on Instagram at Exam Room Nutrition. And I would love to connect with people on Instagram. We have a lot of fun with making different reels and stuff like that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time and your wisdom with us. I think this is going to be so needed and so well received by our listeners.
Thanks so much, Tracy.
I love any conversation that reminds me to get some rest, drink some more water, eat some more fruits and vegetables, and to always be moving my body. There is something so powerful about being reminded that the advice that we give our patients is oftentimes the advice that we should follow in our own lives. Here's to consistency over crash dieting, adding healthful items to our plate, and remembering to give ourselves the grace that we would extend to our patients as we navigate life, health, and the choices we make to fuel ourselves. Be sure to check out the Exam Room Nutrition podcast for more in-depth and detailed information on how to talk to patients about nutrition and how to learn more about nutrition as a provider. That's all for today. This PA is out. Congratulations, you've just joined an awesome club. By listening to a full episode of The PA Is In, you are officially on the Unicorn PA team. Welcome aboard. What most team members do is they subscribe to the podcast because that allows them to automatically get the latest episode of the show. The life of your dreams exists on the other side of taking action. Keep making small shifts and keep getting better. Your life will improve, your career will soar, and you will have the confidence you need to create your own success. I will see you in the next episode. This PA is out.